going to talk about what we know from numerical simulations and some analytic work about angular momentum transport. My collaborators on this have been John Hawley and our student Wayne Winters. Just to set the stage, the formal equation, the formal dynamical equation of accretion disk dynamics can be written in the conservation form that I have shown here, where the momentum stress, in the case of the disk and angular momentum stress, consists of three terms. There's a Reynolds stress, rho dV, pressure term, and then piece which for many years was sort of this troublesome anomalous viscosity, the point here being that, as I'm sure people know, that if you just took molecular viscosity in a disk and made a formal stress tensor out of it, the sort of time scales that you get for accretion would be a couple times longer. So the idea is that there was some anomalous stress that was present that was not understood, but which you just assumed was there to make progress in description that dates back to the Shimura and Sunyaya description 1973. So that's what this sigma is. Sigma could be a formal viscous stress or some additional piece of physics, so the anomalous stress. For example, magnetic fields lend themselves precisely to this formalism, and there are Maxwell stresses that are present. What we now understand, of course, is that the combination of this kind of correlation of the magnetic field and what comes out of the Reynolds stress is enough to get this going. A classical viscous disk theory was able to make progress, you know, in the early days by completely finessing this problem. And many quantities of interest were, one particular quantity of interest, the effective radiating surface temperature of the disk, if radiator like a black body was formally independent of viscosity. So that was a test essentially of local theory. And it was also possible to derive a diffusion equation, time non-steady, an evolving system for the surface density sigma, a result which continues to go over even in the sort of our current understanding of the way accretion disks work, where instead of nu, we actually have that piece of the stress tensor. Well, I think there's a very strong case now at this point that the turbulence which is present in accretion disks is MHD turbulence, and that the viscous stresses are a combination of Reynolds stresses and Maxwell stresses. U R, U 5 here represent the fluctuation velocities, the velocities in excess of the local Kepler velocities, and U A R and U A 5, as I've written them, I put them on, those are simply the Alphane velocities. And the way it's written, I have not distinguished fluctuating components of the magnetic field and mean components of the magnetic field. So that would include, if you will, a sort of turbulent magnetic torque as well as a steady magnetic torque. So this is a stress tensor. That is the actual force. And it is also directly proportional to the angular momentum flux. That quantity normalized with the gas pressure is the classical alpha parameter. And what I draw your attention to here, a particularly important point, that when discussing turbulence, one always has to bear in mind that what matters to the transport is not simply the presence of turbulence itself, but the nature of the correlations that are involved. So, typically, you know, schematically, rather, you have UR sort of something like this, jumping all over the place with either a zero mean or a very small mean. In accretion disk, you want a very small mean because you want it to accrete. And then you have U5, and then generally the idea is that UR, U5, that correlation is, even though fluctuates or correlates to giving you net average value of stress. So not...
You've got to be wired by the FBI.
Am I not the... All
right. You're really dead. Look at that.
Okay. So, not all forms of turbulence are similar to transport properties because they may or may not be correlated. It's worth having its own view, Brad. The essence of turbulence transport, these disks, is how UR correlates with U5 and VR correlates with V5.
The correlation at the same time or different
to the spatial, yeah. The way that the formal.
You got the right one.
Take his wallet.
It'll be recorded.
Reassuring. Okay.
That's your computer.
I'll just talk loud. So, there are two, in principle, two processes that can transport angular momentum, which is kind of the central problem that I'm addressing here. Waves and turbulence. And just to draw some attention to their formal differences, I mean, obviously, I think people have an intuitive idea that turbulence and waves are not the same thing, although in a specific case, if you're just looking at messy data, it's often difficult to disentangle the two. Typically, when you have waves present in the fluid itself is unaffected, at least in the linear regime where the wave simply passes through it. That is to say, there's no kind of change overall in a time average sense of a fluid element's angular momentum, except the wave dissipates. The transport itself tends to be non-local for that reason. The TR phi times d omega d log r is a sort of classical stress by strain quantity, which measures the change of mechanical energy of the fluid. In this case, it represents a free energy exchange between the wave and the differential rotation, and there is a conserved quantity, the wave action. Turbulence, on the other hand, the fluid is directly affected. The angular momentum of a fluid element does change due to the presence of this TR phi times d omega d log r, which represents a true local mechanical energy dissipation rate. There is, of course, as well enhanced transport, and there's a well-known classical result that in accretion disk you release three times as much energy, radiate, dissipate three times as much energy as is locally released in the gravitational potential due to the presence of this enhanced transport ultimately coming from a boundary there. The mechanism of MHD turbulence, or the sort of underlying cause, is this very simple, ultimately, instability, which I've just sort of sketched schematically here. We think of a B field now threading a disk and set up a local Cartesian grid, as shown in the upper left corner there. And imagine taking the field lines and distorting them, as I show in the upper right picture there, with two little red dots being two fluid elements. And now paying tension acts very much like spring tension. In fact, in the linear regime, exactly like spring tension. And the local dynamical equations here for the displacements in the x and the y direction, x being radial, y being azimuthal, are very simple. K dot VA squared is the Alfvén tension, gravitational tidal force between the centrifugal and the central forces and the Coriolis forces. And one can look for and find solutions, simple plane wave solutions with the wave number along the z direction of the magnetic field. And one finds indeed that there are instabilities provided this criterion is met. I've written it in kind of a funny way. Because you notice this is physically the product of the torque and the product of the sort of excess centrifugal force. And it's that combination which should be negative. Now, normally, of course, this is always positive. You don't worry about that. And then if long enough pays, you go to large wave numbers or get very steep fields, then it's simply the criteria that people use to sin, D omega squared, D log R is less than zero. This way, this is actually a very general result. And there are five under much more complicated circumstances.
For example, when you have fall currents in front of stellar disks,
there, it's not exactly this mathematical form, but it is always this combination of the torque and the excess centrifugal force conspiring in the right way, so that fluid element, once it starts to lose its angular momentum, either goes flying out or it goes falling in. You can look at this more formally in the context of classical MHD waves. There's a rather long dispersion relation. In fact, that would be more simple than the general case test. Dispersion relation just for vertical field. A sixth order equation has three distinct modes, the fast, half-thing, and slow modes. The mode that actually goes unstable, not surprisingly, is the slow mode. It's the slow. So I'm going to get hit first. The formal criteria one can work out in detail, and stellar theorists in the audience will recognize in kind of a weird form the Hoyland criteria when you have simultaneously entropy and angular momentum stratification. And interestingly enough, without the magnetic field, these angular velocity gradients or angular momentum gradients, the effect of a weak magnetic field, interestingly enough, it's simply to replace the angular momentum with the angular velocity gradients. It's exactly what happens in the disk when you go from the Rayleigh criteria of angular momentum increasing outward to angular velocity increasing outward for stability. That goes over, that description of replacing angular momentum gradients with angular velocity gradients carries through in more general circumstances. The behavior of a shear layer is in some ways analogous to the behavior of an MHD unstable accretion disk. Both lead to local dissipation of the turbulence. In the case of a shear layer, vorticity stretching is key. That's actually a theme I'm going to come back to in terms of understanding what is going on in shear layers and what may or may not be going on in capillary disks. The point there is that vorticity is conserved. Well, I've written this in kind of a fancy way, that deep looking script in the speaker, right? So that's just vorticity conservation, however you want to write it. The magnetic field satisfies the same thing. Normally, as you know, vorticity and magnetic field satisfy exactly the same equation. Both of them are frozen into fluid. And it is precisely that frozen in relationship which allows the alpha formalism to take place and allows you to formulate a local theory of turbulence.
So you put my mind at rest. I thought it would be omega over rho and d over rho.
Yeah. No, that's right.
But, okay.
It's there. That's quite right. This is a very good feature, which I said it was here. Now, up until a few days ago, I would have said that self-gravity can't be so formulated because it doesn't have a frozen in field equation. Charles Gammy has done some simulations and claims that under some circumstances, in fact, a local formulation, including self-gravitational turbulence, is possible there. So, the Valdez and Pavlovich paper of 1999 goes through the formalism and concludes that that's not something that would apply in general. Charles has a paper on Astro pH yet?
Not yet.
Not yet. Soon to be on Astro pH that has a dissenting point of view, so that's an open question at this stage. So let's go back to this issue of vortex stretching and angular momentum transport. If we're looking at something like molecular viscosity, of course, molecular energy doesn't depend upon an energy source if the collisions are elastic. But if we're talking about eddies, eddies go away unless somehow feed them. They dissipate their energy on a smaller scale. You need a constant energy source to keep them alive and happy. The eddies we lose their energy unless they're fed by shear. Now, it turns out that correlating UX and UI, UX and UI here at this Cartesian chemistry, radial, and as a movable velocity fluctuations, correlating those velocity fluctuations and extracting energy from the mean shear both occur by vortex stretching. Same process leading to good correlation between these guys and also the veins that dominate the transport are the ones that are most effective, of course, at removing energy from the mean flow. Those tend to be the eddies that are aligned at a 45 degree angle relative to the shear. So if that stretching and the conservation of angular momentum speeds up the vorticity that gives you this constant good correlation between UX and UY, which is why in the shear layer, the effective viscous transport, or the effective turbulence transport, is so high. Now, interestingly enough, MHD, although it doesn't need to rely on vortices to extract energy from the shear, because it has a magnetic field to do that, but it is no coincidence that the maximum growth rate, maximum local eigenvector in the MHD instability that is particularly effective, well, it says the most rapid growth rate, so it's particularly effective in extracting energy from shear, is exactly a 45 degree angle relative to the horizontal direction. So, since John Hallblade showed you some, I think, remarkable videos of global simulations and touched on some of the results, I'm going to go over them very quickly here and then move on. The bottom line of now several years of simulations, both local and global models, are sort of the following. There's vigorous enhanced angular momentum transport with the alpha parameter, TR bio, P gas, varying between 0.01, and I want to emphasize this, because a lot of people dump on this and say, well, it's marked as alphas at 0.01. Well, that's not true. You get alphas up to very nearly 1, depending on what your field geometry is. Generally, what happens is that most of the computational work is done for magnetic fields and for a long time just in these local kind of shearing boxes, a way to look at local couette flow, if you will, the magnetic field. And with all the magnetic field kind of self-contained within the box, that is to say the currents have been self-contained, so there's no mean field. And ordinarily, just shake that up, the field will just reconnect and go away. With the MHD instability, it grows and then saturates. But that is it's tough to make that get beyond an alpha parameter of 0.01. If, on the other hand, you have a mean vertical magnetic field inside the box, the alpha parameter can get very large indeed. And there's nothing unphysical about that. It's just that that scheme, and actually when you go to global disk models, when you have a vertical field, is so vigorous that it's computationally difficult to rein in. So one tends to study some of the more pessimistic cases, because at least they're well behaved and you can run them on. But formal values of alpha are down at 0.6, and what value of what regime you're in depends very sensitively on the adopted field geometry. So mean vertical field is important. Global models tend to be more unstable than their local box counterparts. If you have a local shearing box and you want to keep the magnetic field self-contained, then you have a situation where the field has no mean components in it. Your lines go up, go down. A global disk, you have a little bit more freedom. So you have one kind of shearing box here with its own vertical field, and another shearing box over here with its own vertical field. And each of those is much more vigorous. So global models tend to have alphas not of 0.01, but in the simulations that we've done, something close to 0.1. But it's actually been difficult to run these things out to what point that they saturate at some kind of well-determined kind of dynamical steady state. So that's still an ongoing exercise.
Why is that? Could you explain? What's the technical difficulty?
The technical difficulty, it's not so much a technical difficulty as an empirical difficulty, I would say. The thing
to run, and things like the, you see, the idea behind all these sort of accretionist theories is that you have some kind of a, you have a two-scale approximation which ought to hold. That is to say, you can do a sort of local average and get an alpha parameter and have it be well-defined as a function of radius. And in the global simulations, that's difficult to do because often the global simulations have large roles. Number one, the alpha parameter itself, when you try and measure it, changes with time, and at the same time as you run the simulation, the thing is accreting and losing gas. So we haven't been able to quite get to the stage yet where we can just sit back, let the thing go for a couple hundred orbits, and have it sort of be happily sitting there like a classical Shikora in the ion disk. But that's a technical issue.
Have you ever tried examples of your continuous
No, we haven't tried that yet, because, you know, we want to try to keep the number of additional kitchen sinks that we add to the, you know.
Yeah, it's just feasible, but it's what nature does, and also...
But sometimes she does, and sometimes she doesn't.
Technically, though, I think you can say the context of both of steadily increasing binaries, like I've studied in answers on the
right,
and provides a way of forcing things to find line A, specifically said to say, might not be the universal answer. In this field, have you found that at times when you say that it will deal with the physical question, and that it will deal with the physical link between something else?
Yeah, what we've done so far, we have done some simulations with the vertical field. That's so vigorous that it's difficult to follow to the end. That studied examples have things like purely toroidal fields in the disk, where we put in self-contained fields at this point. So,
VR field.
Running nothing chain, VR fields. Just change it. It shears and reconnects.
Reconnects?
Yeah. Well, that's like in the American world.
VR is.
Yeah.
You really have to reconnect in the same direction.
Well, VR. Gets sheared out, and then it also, VR doesn't stay the same, the turbulence itself makes it wiggle back and forth. So, yeah, but there's a tremendous amount of reconnection that goes on all the time, all three times.
Right, the VR
connection.
But the VR is more
mean VR,
I just thought...
The mean VR does
stay,
that's right. Mean VR and the mean VZ, they both have.
More or less.
Well, I think if you have a VZ field, adding a VR to it doesn't make that much of a difference. It does, well, quantitatively, the more you start out with, the more you wind up with, but it's not a, there's a real sea change between having no toroidal field and only a toroidal field, and then adding some component. The other thing that's sort of technically difficult with the VR field is that the maximum growth rates for VR field for a very high vertical wavelength. So pushing the resolution. You want to get back to it. So
yeah, but you don't change the VR,
I don't know.
I what's the answer?
Thank you for the question.
Aren't observations real accretion of pointed alphas rather than like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4?
Oh, it depends what observations you're talking about. If you're talking about protostellar disks, maybe 10 to the minus 4. If you're talking about ADAS, you're talking about 1.
So, this is everything in between. Do we understand how to get accretion alphas that low?
Oh, yeah. No problemo. No, in a weakly magnetized disk, then it's much more complicated. I mean, in a weakly ionized disk.
Oh,
much more complicated. Yeah. Protostellar disks are a whole complex unto themselves. What I'd like to do is to spend some time sharing with you a little bit something which, at some level, is kind of self-education. But it's something that I have found extremely useful when I've been thinking about this problem, and I think perhaps maybe
underappreciated. That is that there is a very deep analogy between entropy stratification and angular momentum stratification in the behaviors of sort of dual systems. If you look at an accretion disk with its radially stratified angular momentum there, and you look at a stratified atmosphere with its stratified entropy, and look at the internal waves for the atmosphere, the internal gravity waves, and the inertial waves, they have remarkably similar properties. But it's not just the waves. It's the, what I want to sort of emphasize is that the detailed behavior of these systems is remarkably similar, and has even led to sort of an interesting result, and that is that there is an entropy analog of the magnetic rotational instability, where you have entropy transfer between fluid elements resulting in a runaway, which I'll get to later in the talk. So it's not an idea that I came up with on my own, or that certainly wasn't the first. Already back in 1928, Jeffries pointed out that the critical Reynolds number for the onset of instability in Taylor-Couet experiments, 1908, but it's exactly the same as the critical Taylor number in Rayleigh-Bernard flow. The two problems in this case happen to be identical mathematically.
Do you want to remind us what those two flows are?
Taylor-Couet flow is simply the flow between two concentric spheres. That was
cylinders.
Thank you. Differentially rotating. That was first studied, I guess, by Couet in 1890, and Taylor did a classic experiment in 1923. And Rayleigh-Bernard flow is simply the onset of convection.
Would you be willing to change critical Taylor number to critical Rayleigh number?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right. Critical Rayleigh number. What I want to show now is how this carries over not just to these sort of linear stability calculations, but to understanding something as complicated as turbulent transporting. For example, let's look at a layer where we have entropy stratification. When S, the entropy, decreases upward, that is to say, opposite from the direction of gravity, convective turbulence is more spontaneous. The effect of thermal conductivity is enhanced. So let me pose the following problem. What if some other form of turbulence happened to be present in what would otherwise be a stably stratified layer with the temperature decreasing upward, like a radio concern? So here's my initial kind of cartoon picture. I have a T lower and a T upper, and an S lower and an S upper. S is entropy. T upper is less than T lower, but the entropy is higher. Now I have these fluid elements, and because there's turbulence, they come together and they mix up, and then they eventually separate. Well, the interesting thing here is that if they are moving, and the turbulence is nearly adiabatic, of course the entropy has to be preserved. So again, in my middle position here, I have a T2, and I have an S2 and an S1, the entropies. S2 is the same as my initial S upper. S1 is the same as my initial S lower. So I have a situation now where the entropy for these two fluid elements, which are commingling at the same pressure, and they have this difference in entropy. The point here is that when they get together, because of this entropy conserving the adiabatic property, the temperature of T2 has to be bigger than the temperature of T1, even though it started out less. The point is that to increase entropy, he has to go from hot to cold in the mixing process, which gives you a result that ultimately this lower fluid element, which started out with a lower temperature, excuse me, higher temperature, wind up as the recipient of the heat. So in this sense, the heat is going at some level backwards relative to what it would do in a convectively stable layer. Now, you don't get that for free, obviously. There has to be some other energy source driving this pump. And that's what the effect of this other turbulence is. So this is a more formal way of deriving the same result by conserve energy here by having the temperatures of these two fluid elements the same. I demand that entropy increase due to their interactions, and then one can show very straightforwardly that delta T, temperature of the lower fluid element, the one that started out hotter,
when you study accretion disks and drive turbulence in such a disk by something other than a dynamical instability, something other than the MHD instability, for example, convection. Here we have a situation when L decreases outward in the disk. The shear turbulence is, of course, spontaneous. The effect of viscosity is enhanced. I pose the question, what if some other form of turbulence were present in a stable disk with omega decreasing outwards? So here you can see what the analogy is doing. Where I had temperature, I now had angular velocity. Both of those are sources of free energy. Where I had entropy, I now have angular momentum, locally conserved quantity. I start out with omega lower being bigger than omega upper for outer. But the angular momentum is reversed. The upper angular momentum is bigger than the lower angular momentum. I bring the fluid elements together, and if there is a tendency to conserve the angular momentum as I draw them in together, and that's the key here, then I have a situation where, once again, I have my upper angular momentum bigger than my lower angular momentum, but they're at the same location. So the one that has a bigger angular momentum is at the same location now. By the time it gets here, its omega has gotten bigger. The result is that angular momentum goes from the faster moving god to the slower moving god, that is to say, once again, inwards. Angular momentum must go in if, once again, the entropy is increased by the mixing, that is to say, if there's dissipation. You go through a similar exercise of conserving overall angular momentum, but allowing the mechanical energy to be lost by a small factor epsilon, you can prove that the lower god actually increases angular momentum. Running out of time, there are graphical ways of arguing the same point. I'm going to skip over those and get to the bottom line here. This is a run that Jim Stone and I, three-dimensional local calculation of a convectively unstable shearing box, but with otherwise there's no magnetic field here. The only turbulence that was present was convection. The calculation, or similar calculations, has since been repeated by a number of different authors. Cabot had a paper in 96, and more recently there is a paper by Igor Menchev, Romovich, and Ryan studied the same thing in the context of ADAS, three-dimensional accretion flows with convection present. They all find qualitatively similar results. This is a plot of effectively the stress tensor as a function of time. And we've extended it, I guess, even farther than I've shown here. But there's no question that the net angular momentum transport under these circumstances is definitely inward. It's small because you have things bouncing around, but it is absolutely unambiguous in nature. Trying to prove this more formally from looking at the fluctuation equations themselves, then for the case of entropy transport, it's relatively simple. You can prove that in convectively stable air, this correlation, U delta T, U is the fluctuation velocity, and delta T is the temperature fluctuation, must be negative. But most of you can say for angular momentum transport, this is kind of the heart of the issue, is that this combination together with pressure gradient, so it's more difficult to absolutely prove, except in two dimensions. Obviously, it has to go inward, and in fact, in two dimensions, the analogy holds precisely mathematically. So, what is happening, obviously, is that in the simulations, this term is negative, and the PPI term is not dominant. Perhaps this isn't so too surprising because in the metal stress itself, which is kind of the source of the instability of the turbulence. Now, I would also hasten to add that, of course, since this was a general equation, we couldn't get a result. An angular momentum always had to go inward because we hope doesn't.
know, you can have a trailing density with spiral waves, and then you do transport angular momentum outward, in which case this pressure term is the more important one. So, let's see if we can get some insight as to what is going on and why it is that the pressure term isn't quite so critical over here under those circumstances. One of the things that we have concentrated on is exclusively the role of turbulent density. In the case of an accretion disk, when one has convection present, it's not so clear that that's the whole story. What tends to happen, of course, is that the disk is rotationally dominated, whereas if you have vertical convection, the Brunt Mosler frequency tends to get very small. And establish a nearly adiabatic temperature gradient in vertical direction. Nevertheless, in general, if one makes displacements which are in the disk plane itself, it's possible to get a wave-like response even in the presence of the turbulence, because the turnover time for the turbulence tends to be somewhat slow compared to the oscillation time. Under those circumstances, you can have, in addition to convective mixing going on, as a possibility that one can have wave transport going on as well. I have here a funny plot. This is a plot of the wave surfaces for an accretion disk, where the Brunt-Mosler frequency is zero. So I have just purely inertial waves, just that cyclic types of waves. I'm plotting here the QZ wave number, the Z wave number, and the R wave number, some soon to be dimensionless units. And these are surfaces of constant omega, constant response. They actually turn out to be confocal, hyperbole, and ellipses. It's, you can use conformal mapping techniques to study this for reasons that appear to be somewhat accidental. But these are surfaces with constant omega. And the nice thing about plotting this up this way is that you can instantly see by looking at the group velocity of the normals of these surfaces which way the angular momentum is going. Because the density waves to the surface depend here. It's also, by the way, not a coincidence that these surfaces actually look like surfaces of density waves. But that's another story. At the moment these are just constant omega surfaces, their group velocity is normal. It's radially outward. These are the surfaces of constant omega for the inertial waves, and you notice, not surprisingly, that those are all pointing inward and upward, so inward in the radial direction. And in fact, one can show quite generally that the direction of angular momentum transport doesn't depend upon the sign of pressure gradient. It depends upon, it doesn't depend on the size of the pressure gradients for these waves. It depends entirely on what the local omega is. Where this actually is curly pi is omega minus m omega, as I have a disk. This is a very general relationship which applies not only to inertial waves but to density waves under extremely general circumstances. It's a very simple formula, which I think is sort of underused. The point here is that you can relate the stress tensor of the wave, the direction of angular momentum transport, and for a trailing wave configuration, one that kind of swoops back in the direction of the shear as you go radially outward, m over, this is a positive quantity, everything depends upon whether you're driving the wave at faster or slower than the epicyclic frequency. When it tends to be dominated by the cyclic response, either the turbulent or the wave regime, tends to push stuff backwards. Backwards to what is sort of a traditional way of looking at it. Here's an intuitive way to understand what is going on as well with these waves. Here is a trailing wave in blue. Omega is shown. You notice the tail flies back here. And drawn here is sort of epicyclic motion. That everything along this phase line would be doing in harmony. Up here, on this part of the epicyclic branch, the angular momentum is less than the surroundings. This is kind of a low angular momentum. coming back, so this is the high end of it. And you're sure we gave this nice analogy about people leaning over on the buses to get angular momentum, the convection going one way. Well, you have the same thing over here. You have people leaning over in the buses here. All these arrows are lined up to give you low angular momentum being pushed out this way, exactly along the wavelength, and higher angular momentum being pushed back inwards. That's why it follows exactly along the constant wave path and gives you angular momentum transport, opposite to what you would expect. All right. I'm out of time, so I'm not going to have a chance to discuss this interesting analogy with the entropy stratification of the magnitude of rotation instability.
Somebody can ask that question.
Someone can ask that question. I haven't had time to talk about hydrodynamic stability. So let me just put up my summary. I know it's always dangerous to be the last speaker before lunch. I don't want to violate the good reasons of the audience. Point number one, origins of classical alpha disk behavior, I think, are now understandable directly from the NHDA equations, assuming two scale assumptions to derive the behavior of the stresses. Point number two, entropy and angular momentum stratification are deeply analogous physical systems. Omega and T are analogs of each other. Both of these are three sources. Entropy and angular momentum are the two conserved quantities. They have analogous waves. They have analogous variational principles they can be derived from. They have analogous mixing markings. Heat and angular momentum must go backwards. I didn't have time to talk about three. And number four was the sort of formal point on the waves. So I have a new point number four. Inward angular momentum transport by convection in this is something which I think is robust, and I think is probably also connected with eventually what I believe to be the nonlinear stability. I think the two are related. The fact that the angular momentum is going uphill is perhaps not too surprising to the people who study angular momentum transport in the solar convection zone, where precisely the same kind of thing occurs. At some point, you've got to be transporting angular momentum not only against the angular velocity gradient, but against the angular momentum gradient. And then five, we have seen no numerical evidence for nonlinear high Reynolds number instability, and I think it would be hard to reconcile, to say the least, with what is now a body of interwoven numerical results in analytic arguments. But I'm afraid I'll have to stop there.
Let me ask you about the non-local transport due to a high magnetic field. In that case, you would really change the same thing this along because it's always generating the difference.
It may not even be just a picture. It may not be a turbulent problem. You could have a magnetic sphere
I think what I'm asking is the best observations of those sort of steady-state disks are going to be outdoors, where the long part of my report has more or less been observed. So if you just comment on the impression I got was if you get high alphas, you need non-local, local transport. So
that oh, no.
Impression?
That's a false impression. You can get the alphas that we were talking about, for example, the alpha 0.06 was obtained in a local simulation. What you need is to have a mean local field at a high value. Well, it doesn't mean that you can't get them into something other than a local period.
Okay,
would
you like to
say? So how about the entropy thing? How about the entropy analogy?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. This is kind of neat. Totally unexpected. And it's testable. So here's the idea. If you look at the magnetorotational instability, then you get one of the key conceptual points is what Lindenbell called donkeydom. I like very much. Pull on something and it wants to go back the opposite way. So in this case, we have two fluid elements. We
which are tethered by a spring or a magnetic field. And as I pull back on this one with my spring, or rather, this one trying to get ahead, it pulls on the upper fellow, increases its angular momentum, and it separates. The lower guy loses angular momentum and falls down. That increases the tension in the field line, and the process tends to run away. The angular momentum transfer rate increases as the separation increases. The magnetic field is the agent. And the stability criterion, we've analyzed, it goes from a gradient to a conserved quantity, L, Rayleigh criterion, to a gradient in the free energy domain. Let's say omega decreases downwards, it becomes stable. So there will be something that taps into the entropy gradient in the same way. So this is how it would work in principle. I have a couple of fluid elements now, and I have an entropy transfer from the lower one to the upper one. It's hotter at the bottom, and it's cooler at the top, but it's stable by the Schwarzschild criterion, so the entropy here is significantly bigger than it is here. So if I scrap this off, I somehow have to have this guy gain P, rise, and just like in the angular momentum cases, the one that rises to higher angular momentum actually goes at a smaller angular velocity. This nevertheless has to cool because of its rising and adiabatic expansion. As I separate, here's the hard part, I have to get the entropy transfer rate to go faster as the separation increases. And that's the part which is not so obvious to get. Let me show you what works. Look at now a weakly magnetized diffuse stratified plasma. We have thermal conduction present, and the field is sufficiently weak that it has no dynamical consequences, but it restricts the temperature flow only along its field line. I have two fluid elements. My initial configuration, there's no heat flow between them because they're on an isotherm. And now I make the separation. You see what happens. The field lines fire a direction, a blue arrow, they drive, they fire a component in the direction of temperature gradient. What happens is that heat tends to flow from the lower to the upper element. The sky captures it, it tends to rise, this one falls. That stretches the field lines even more parallel to the temperature gradient, which becomes thus more efficient, and the process runs away. Furthermore, you can show that indeed this cloud, even though it's gaining entropy, is actually cooling, but still it's hot enough relative to the surroundings that it keeps on rising and this one keeps on sinking. The formal stability analysis of that system has properties which are exactly analogous to the MRI. The stability criterion does depend upon the strength of the magnetic field. You go from the instability criterion being one of an entropy gradient decreasing outwards to a temperature gradient decreasing outwards, and you get very rapid growth rate. This is the sort of thing, you have radius of diffusion in a star or something, it's very, very different. So this, the element for this sort of a process would be something like the interstellar medium, where you might have a hot plasma, a deep magnetic field, and some sort of gravity stratification. But this is still something which is very, very new.
Question on the analysis.
Yeah.
Just trying to see how deep it goes. If I have two fluid elements and submit them, just transfer of one from under the other and generate it from
the magnetorotational instability itself, if you have an angular velocity gradient, it doesn't matter what its sign is for that to exist.
Oh, no, because it must decrease outward. The angular velocity increases outward.
Oh, that's, I mean, I can tell you in spherical shells, it does. That may be a difference between the spherical shell case or the global case.
The spherical shell case, it makes a difference. It doesn't.
Oh. Just the presence of the angular velocity gradient is enough to give you to make the profile unstable to a Maxwell stress. It doesn't matter what the sign is, I don't think. In fact, all the calculations that I've done, others have done with me, is for the angular velocity increasing hours. That is the solar case.
In some situation where you've got pressure balancing gravity rather than centrifugal force balancing gravity.
I don't.
Yeah. I mean, that would make a difference.
No, actually it doesn't. I mean, the MRI, this particular, I mean, it may be a different kind of thing.
Because my image of what...
The MRI doesn't matter even if you have a pressure support.
Does it depend on field orientation at all? I mean, certainly this is true for toroidal fields, let's put it that way. If you have toroidal field and differential rotation.
No, the basics of the MRI are not dependent upon the orientation.
Hmm.
But they do require the angular velocity increasing the hours. But it may just be a different type of process. What we can
sort
that out.
Well, as you know, you can decide whether a star's pulsation is stable by computing work integral. So, assuming that we're adiabatic, we need to look at the integral Vs over T to have, basically it has to be gamma.